welcome, beloved listeners, to our little wireless program. The great democracy of India, let us never forget, was born in carnage. So many Hindus and Muslims slaughtered each other at the moment of the nation's birth. But generally, relations between Hindus and Muslims have been under control. Well, at the moment, they're looking quite dangerous. And as you've heard, a number of Muslims have been butchered for the religious crime of eating beef. And until minutes ago, really, the Hindu Prime Minister has been strangely silent about it. We'll look at that story shortly. And then we're going to go down to Tasmania and meet a young historian who's using a new tool provided by the National Library to write a different sort of history. And I think you'll find that what he's done, what he's discovered, and how he's done it are all pretty much equally interesting. But first, an invitation, dear Gladys. If you're in Sydney on Wednesday, November the 18th, check your diary. We'd like to invite you to a rather special event. They're calling it An Evening with Curious Minds, and the Curious Minds are my colleagues, Fran Kelly, Robin Williams, and I. We're all having anniversaries at the microphone. It's at the UTS in the new Geary Design Building, and the host will be our distinguished colleague, Richard Fidler, from the enormously popular Conversations program. Now, here's how you get along, and we'd love you to come. You go to the RN website and you subscribe to the RN newsletter, and you'll get your very first newsletter this Friday. And then you can find out how to register for the event, which, of course, is free on the evening of November the 18th. So sign up for the newsletter. The rest is easy. And Fran and Robin and Richard and I will look forward to seeing you on that great occasion. Ever since India's Prime Minister attained power, in fact, before he attained power, there were fears that he would fan the flames of Hindu nationalism. The BJP has a long history of doing just that. And now those fears seem to be confirmed. In September, a group of extremists murdered a Muslim man near Delhi. His alleged crime was that he ate beef, which, of course, is not actually illegal. It's just theologically frowned upon. Now, since then, three more murders of Muslims and several hundred attacks on minorities, and ministers in Modi's BJP party responded by, would you believe, encouraging people to attack and even kill anyone they suspected of the slaughter and consumption of cows. Well, until this week, the PM has been silent. Now, a global protest from writers, intellectuals, has finally forced Modi to try and water things down or calm things down, but is it too little too late? And what does this mean for the future of, yes, the world's largest democracy? I had hoped to be joined by not one but two New Delhi-based journalists, one of them Kavita Krishna, the editor of Liberation magazine, but at the moment we're not able to make contact. But we're very fortunate to have Mandakini Garlot, who's a reporter for, among other things, France 24 and Al Jazeera. Mandakini, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Philip.
Can you give me a bit of a background here? India's Muslims make up, what, around 15% of the population?
A little less than 15%, yes. Yes.
A growing percent or a slowly reducing percent?
Well, many would say a growing community, to be honest, but they're certainly not growing as fast as the Hindu right-wing fears that they are. For example, between the last two census, between 2001 and 2011, the Muslim community in India recorded, let's say, about 1% of growth, whereas Hindus recorded a slight decline in population numbers. But still, fact remains that Hindus constitute over 80% of the people in this country, and Muslims account for about 14-point-something%.
Can you take us back to September when Mohammed Akhlaq was killed? What do we know about the circumstances of his murder?
Absolutely. I'd like to start out by saying that this has been building up for a while, this gradual radicalization within certain fringe groups in the country. Now, it really all came to a boil with Muhammad Akhlaq's lynching. Now, what appears to have happened is that Muhammad Akhlaq lived in a village called Bisara, a Hindu-majority village, and there was a rumor in the village that somebody had slaughtered a cow. Now, cows are, of course, sacred to Hindus. An announcement was made in the temple, and a large, heavily armed mob made its way to Akhlaq's house, where he was brutally beaten up. You know, they used a sewing machine to smash his head in. His son was critically injured and had to undergo two brain surgeries, and all of this on the basis of a rumor. Now, the meat that was found in Akhlaq's house was sent for forensic testing to a lab, and we've still not had any results on that. But fact remains, even if it was beef, just to put it into context here, beef is, in fact, slaughtering of cows is illegal in the state that Akhlaq lived in, but still, if it was beef, it's a law and order issue. But here we have a situation where the mob seems to have taken law and order into their own hands and are meting out punishment as they see fit. And it's not the only case. Since then, we've heard of other such attacks.
I understand that the police were there, but basically just let it happen.
Yes, the police were present in the area and, in fact, responded to complaints about a situation that was building up, but they were much smaller in numbers. I visited the village 2 days after this happened and spoke to the chief police inspector there, and he said, look, what could we do? There were 10 of us and there were 1,000 of them, and there's not much we could have done. Now, that's what they've been saying. But what's also been observed is that the police, in many cases, allows these things to happen. The police is largely composed of Hindus, and as such, their own, biases tend to creep in when it comes to taking actions against such incidents.
And was it true that the men finally arrested for the crime were found to be relatives of a local BJP campaigner?
Absolutely. If I'm not mistaken, there were about 11 arrests, and 9 of those people were related to a local BJP worker, including his son. And this is a man who has been accused of inciting violence in other places in Uttar Pradesh, most notably in the run-up to the general election in 2014. So, yes.
I should point out to the listener that, yes, there are McDonald's all over the place, but they serve goat meat. Okay. In some Indian states, let's clarify this, Hindu nationalists have successfully introduced blanket bans on beef. And in essence, these bans are saying to Muslims, you're not welcome here.
Absolutely. And in fact, let me also tell you, it's not just that McDonald's serves goat meat. There's many places, and increasingly more so now, where we see a lot of restaurants have to be vegetarian only. And you'll find this in cities like Bombay, which is, or I should say Mumbai, to be honest, which is a very cosmopolitan city, has always had a diverse mix of religions and people living there. But increasingly, this beef has become such a big issue, and you have restaurants that can only function if they are vegetarian only. So,
but in a way, this is not really about beef. This is a much more profound and ancient conflict.
Absolutely. It's like you mentioned when you started the show, that there's always been a degree of tension between the Hindu community and the Muslim community in India ever since 1947. There was the partition and a lot of violence that took place at the time. But I think what worries everyone and is extremely disturbing is how brazen it's gotten. For example, you'll have mobs just going into villages, attacking minorities, attacking anyone who doesn't agree with their opinion, and they seem to be getting away with it. There's very little decisive action taken against them. Ideally, one would like that these groups are declared outlawed in some manner, or stricter actions taken against them. But they seem to be getting away with a lot of violence in the current environment.
I'm surprised by this. I was actually in Delhi talking to the president, who was a wonderful fellow, whilst the BJP were rioting outside the gates just before they they first attained power. And the world was very concerned about this ultranationalism. But Modi seems to have convinced the world that everything was much more amiable.
Right, because he campaigned on grounds of, look, I want to get past religion, I want to get past caste, we need to focus on poverty, we need development, and that's what I'm going to focus on. And that's how he campaigned, and very fairly won a very large election. And since coming to power, to be fair to him, he has, on various instances, tried to keep some sort of distance between him and the very, very radical elements within his party and affiliated to his party. But he often falls short of taking any direct action. Like in the case of Mohammad Akhlaq, who was lynched recently, Prime Minister Modi remained silent about the incident for the longest time. And when he did eventually speak, it's my personal opinion that he was pretty disappointing, because he came out and said, well, what can the center do? What can the central government do in this case? States have to take more responsibility. And that's not how Indians want to hear their prime minister right now. The president, on the other hand, has been very progressive on this issue. Yesterday again, he came out and spoke quite openly, made a statement asking people to maintain peace and to be tolerant, to keep in mind the values that Indian democracy was built on.
Mandakini, in a report you did for Al Jazeera, you interviewed some of the more militant Hindu leaders. What do they have to say for themselves?
Right. In particular, we interviewed a group called Bajrang Dal, which is a very large group. They've been around for years, but they've come under the scanner lately because they're involved in a lot of this stopping trucks on highways to see if anyone is transporting beef. And it was frightening because the language that they use is very, very violent. For instance, the head of Bajrang Dal in a very large state called Uttar Pradesh said to me, well, if minorities cannot respect the Hindu way of life, then they should consider leaving the country. Others said that perhaps we should withdraw voting rights for Muslims. So there's a lot of, they've created an atmosphere where you have to believe in Hindu values. Now, those values are very vague. One doesn't understand what they're talking about. But largely, they say that India is a country where it's called Hindustan, and in Hindi, India is referred to as Hindustan. And they believe that anyone who wants to live in Hindustan, to live in India, should, believe in Hindu values. And they keep quoting the holy scriptures or the Vedas, as they're known here, to find justification for all their actions. So, for example, the whole violence around beef thing, very recently they've been talking a lot about, oh, well, the scriptures say that if anyone kills a cow, then technically they're sinners, and violence against sinners is permissible. So they're really going back to the holy books to find a justification for violence that's quite unacceptable.
You also had a chance to get into some of the schools being set up by the militants, which, as you point out, teach an alarmingly lopsided view of Indian history.
Right. I spent some time at a camp, in fact, wasn't a school, to be honest. It's a camp. It's a group called Durga Vahini, which is a group for young Hindu girls between the ages of 15 and 35. And these camps are held all over the country in the summer. They're usually between a week to a month long. And we spent a week there, and it was quite disturbing because these are really young girls, and they were being taught things like, you shouldn't marry Muslim men. Muslim men are being paid a lot of money by madrasas and other groups to seduce you and to marry you, and later they'll just divorce you. This is their way of reducing the Hindu population in the country. There's absolutely no proof that anything of this sort is happening. There's a word for it. In fact, the Hindu groups have coined this term called love jihad, which essentially they've created fear amongst the North Indian states amongst young Hindu girls that be careful, the Muslim boys are coming after you. And there's been a lot of violence around the love jihad issue. Boys, young Muslim boys are often caught and beaten up and mistreated in other ways. So I remember at the camp, I was really shocked because there was a major right-wing leader who came to speak to the girls one day, and he told them this very bizarre story about how in Islam, the culture allows them to cut up their wives and eat them if they run out of all food. And I was shocked that he would say that, but I was even more shocked that the girls seemed to believe this. They bought into his message quite easily. So it's, I don't really have the numbers of how many girls are attending these camps because they're a bit secretive, and it took us a long time to get access to film at one such camp. But I would imagine the numbers are growing larger.
I'm sorry to interrupt. I'm wondering to what extent this issue is being exacerbated by endless tensions between India and Pakistan, which of course came into being as a consequence of partition. Does it have a larger theatre?
It definitely does, but I think on the whole, for the moment, Pakistan is definitely an issue. Just in the last 1 week alone, we've seen attacks on writers. A very famous writer who was on his way to launch the Pakistani former foreign minister's book in India. And while he was on his way there, a mob, this is a political party called the Shiv Sena, which is in alliance with Prime Minister Modi's party in the state of Maharashtra. They sort of waylaid him and threw ink onto his face. And then 2 days ago, they disrupted a meeting between the cricket boards of India and Pakistan, who were having talks to resume cricket ties between the two countries. So Pakistan's most certainly a huge issue when it, like, the radical right-wing groups definitely talk about Pakistan quite a bit. But what's very, very disturbing is that now a lot of this hatred seems to be directed at Indian Muslims who've always they're citizens of India, but in the manner that the Hindu right-wing groups are now starting to talk about the Muslim community in India, it's almost as if they're talking about foreigners. So they'll say things like they should go back to the country they came from.
This is LNL On Air, online on your mobile device, and we're talking about the surge, the spike in Hindu fundamentalism in India. I'm just, as you're well aware, Al Jazeera got itself into deep trouble in Egypt, and our colleague Peter Gresty was one of its victims. I have to ask you this. How's Al Jazeera regarded in India? Are you likely to get into trouble if you maintain this sort of analysis of governmental naughtiness?
Right. Well, I'm happy to say that there's still a great degree of press freedom in India. Despite everything else, you can say, you can express unpopular opinions, and at least the government will not attack you. But again, there's been an increase in writers and journalists getting attacked for their opinions. So this film came out about 2 weeks ago, and since then I've had just a world of grief from all sorts of radical groups. There have been letters and messages, largely on social media, you know, asking me to leave the country or threatening me in other ways. But on the whole, the government, I haven't heard from either the BJP or the Prime Minister's office, which I think is, reason to be hopeful about. There's a lot of press freedom still in India. You can say the things that need to be said.
Well, one of the things you've reported on are forced conversions being carried out by militant Hindu groups. Can you tell me about those?
So this really came to light in December 2014. In Agra, which is in the state of Uttar Pradesh. This is Agra, where the Taj Mahal is, has a large population of Muslim. And there were stray reports about how a group of Muslim rag pickers had been invited to a ceremony where they would get, ration cards, which are essentially cards which they can use to buy food grains at a subsidized rate. And so this group went to this ceremony where they were made to do very in Hindu style ceremony, and the next thing they knew, they were told, okay, you're Hindus now, your ancestors came to India many years ago, they were converted by the Muslim kings, and now we're welcoming you back home. They called it homecoming. So under the homecoming program, they have targets like, in 1 year we have to reconvert. They don't use the word convert. They say we have to reconvert 10,000 Muslims and bring them back home because centuries ago their ancestors used to be Hindus. And the law is very vague about this because conversions are permissible in India as long as they're out of choice. But here it appears that they weren't out of choice, that these people were forced. But not much legal action has been taken on that front. And from what we hear, reconversion ceremonies are still taking place all over the country, but they're a lot more discreet about it now.
What's the contrast, or rather, how is social media responding to this? Because I know how energetic that is in India.
Social media, there's so much polarization on the social media. So every time, in fact, social media is where you feel attacked the most because there's a large number of people who identify with the radical Hindu opinion, and they've really come out in very large numbers to attack any writer or even citizen who dares to question their beliefs. And a lot of these threats and attacks don't appeal to any reason at all. You cannot engage them in conversation and explain, look, I wrote such and such column because I really believe that democracy is under threat. No, every time you say something that they disagree with, it's just a torrent of abuse that's directed at you. So social media is extremely polarized. There are two very clear camps.
Well, there's a lot of
fighting going on online.
Sorry, there's one very clear camp with writers and intellectuals who are rallying, and I understand quite a few writers have been returning literary awards in protest.
That's right. I'm not sure what the numbers are now, but on last count, over 30 writers, some of India's finest, returned their awards to a state institution called the Sahitya Academy, which is a major literary body in India. And it started with a writer called Nayanthara Sehgal, who also happens to be the niece of India's first Prime Minister, Jawaharlal Nehru, and she came out and she said, look, there's a rising tide of violence and intolerance in this country, and as such, this is the only way I can think of to lodge a formal protest. Now, she was also, she says she was compelled to do this because in the last 18 months, we've seen three very progressive writers murdered in cold blood. Nobody's been charged with their murders as yet, but these are writers who expressed opinions that went against the Hindu beliefs currently. For example, Professor M.M. Kalburgi, who was murdered in August, he was 77 years old, a very, very vocal critic of idol worship and other rituals in Hinduism, and he was gunned down by unknown assailants. So a lot of writers have come forward to protest these murders, and really they've started a dialogue and debate about what's happening currently.
Well, the Prime Minister's got to watch himself because, as we all recall, Washington wasn't that thrilled about his election. He was regarded as a great problem in human rights areas, and here he is, he's become acceptable, he's done a victory lap around Australia, which was politically very effective, but if he doesn't sort this out, it's not going to be good for him, and it's certainly not going to be good for India. Might be good for the cows, but it'll be terrible for the Muslims. We didn't get on to Kavita Krishnan, editor of the Communist Party's magazine Liberation, but we were very fortunate that Mardukya Gahlot spent so much time with us, a reporter and documentary maker for France 24 and Al Jazeera. And this is LNL. Up next, as promised, we're going to talk to a young historian who, using a new tool provided by the National Library, is writing history in a very fresh and different way. And what he's come up with is, I think, delightful and astonishing. Write this down, beloved listener. Trove. It's the National Library of Australia's online system, and it brings together content from all sorts of sources. And my next guest, historian, archaeologist Nick Brody, has managed to extensively chart his family history, from the first Irish convict up to himself, a university lecturer from Hobart. In fact, without Trove, 5 years ago, this book called Kin, A Real People's History of Our Nation, wouldn't have been possible. And in it, he's also drawing on the history of a nation, from Botany Bay to Federation, Gallipoli and Darwin, and not only the sum of his ancestors' experiences, but that of a nation, reflected in its farmers, coachmen, stockmen, squatters, nurses, butchers, the good wives and the bad husbands. And Nick, unlike some historians, has attempted not to wear armbands of any particular colour in retelling his family history. I welcome him now from the Hobart studio. Tell us about Thomas Kennedy, Nick.
Thomas Kennedy is my earliest traceable ancestor in Australia, so he forms the start of this big picture history of Australia using my family tree as the essential narrative device. And poor old Thomas was, well, at the time he was poor young Thomas. He was about 14 years old, living in Dublin as an apprentice. And he got himself into a bit of trouble because he associated with a group of people who didn't like the British to be in charge. And he was accused of plotting to help bring the French over to dispose of the English and the English crown.
I'm told that he was suspected of being a member of a specific group, a defender.
Yeah, they called themselves the Defenders. The Defenders was quite an interesting phenomenon, kind of a similar thing to the Orangemen, but on the Catholic-Irish side, if you can think of it that way, as kind of an organised group which is partly seditious, partly a book discussion group almost, where they would read Thomas Paine and get together and talk political theory. So it's kind of
and of course, this is occurring in pretty much the era of the French Revolution, so the Brits would have got a bit nervous.
Yes, it was a very bad time to be doing these sorts of things and talking about the possibilities of what might happen if the British were to go.
Okay, now the climate in Britain, anxiety over losing more colonies after losing America, and this was one of the reasons for the crowded hulks and fending off French advances in the Pacific.
Yeah, there's quite a lot going on around the world at this time. So the loss of the American colonies, basically a generation before, obviously made English landlords fairly nervous because, of course, a lot of their money came from plantations and economic connections there, as well as basic, you know, the revolutionary fervour of the event. And then just about the same time, things are starting to heat up in France and it looks like things are going to go badly there. So for Thomas to be engaging with these sorts of things at the moment, just after the French Revolution, when it's all just going to pot, is pretty poor timing, really.
You also write that Sydney Cove was a powerful assertion to the world that despite what international jurists were proclaiming, sovereignty over land was rightly vested in only sovereigns.
Yeah, that's my own take on the settlement of Australia, because I've, of course, grown up in the academy in an age where we've focused a lot on frontier relations and the kind of juridical aspect of British colonisation and the rights and the wrongs of it and the justification and terra nullius and exploring history in a post-Mabo world in a way where we were much more aware of it. But I think there's also an aspect of it that's being missed, which is that bigger picture whereby the British Crown is really concerned to assert the fact that it is sovereigns that theoretically own all land. So the lack of a sovereign is itself almost an excuse enough. This idea of the sovereignty being vested in the people is something that's very much being worked out at this time anyway. So the British see Australia as a bit of a statement, not just a geopolitical one to move into the Pacific, but also a counteraction to the loss of the American colonies.
If I had a relative, a forebear, an antecedent like Thomas Kennedy, I'd be pretty proud of him because he's about to be transported on the Britannia. But there are reports of a planned mutiny even before it departed from Cork, and that he might have been the ringleader.
Yes, I'm not sure I actually believe those rumours, but they're really fascinating ones nonetheless, and I'll take credit for them on his behalf. The idea that the Irish were really fighting not to be transported, I think, is a really important one in overcoming a perception of all convicts as necessarily victims. They certainly fought and struggled to avoid it as best as possible, and mutiny was a very real possibility for a number of convict ships.
I understand that one out of every 17 died as a result of mistreatment and excessive punishment.
Yes, well, of course, once you commit an act or something that could be approximated as mutinous, then the captain and the guards in charge didn't look too kindly on you. And in the case of the Britannia, the captain kind of went really overboard. And when it finally arrived in New South Wales, the governor actually initiated an investigation because it was obvious from straight away, basically, that the convicts were in a really emaciated and bad state. And with the
high death rate, there was talk of one woman suiciding. Others had their heads shaved, chained and beaten. It sounds absolutely horrific.
Yeah, it's almost like a stereotype from a movie of what the oppressive convict system was like, and it certainly illustrates the possibilities because of the lack of administrative oversight and the way that the whole system was working its way out in those early days.
Now, Thomas's future wife, Mary, was also transported from Ireland for pretty much the same reasons.
Yeah, she was an Irish girl whose transportation to New South Wales seems to fit within the same milieu, although she's one of those ones where I couldn't quite find the reason, the specific charge for it at the time. But she's transported in the wake of riots, which themselves follow the defender's transportation. So it seems likely that she's caught up in that whole process of agitation in Dublin about English rule and the treatment of English, Irish political dissent, and therefore she ends up on the boat as well.
My guest is Nick Brody, and we're delving into his past. And tell us now about the hat-stealing convict James Kiss, because he tells us through his history a very different story.
James Kiss could almost be a stereotype of what we think convicts were, which is somebody who committed a small property crime and then was transported. So James was convicted of stealing a hat, and because he stole that hat, he was transported to New South Wales. But in actuality, once you look a little bit more closely at what was going on, it was a case of fisticuffs and a bit of a lover's dispute by the looks of it, because he's charged with assault as well on a poor fellow whose hat he steals. And it seems to me that the hat stealing is actually tacked on as an additional charge. And so the focus of the law shifts to the hat in the end, and he gets transported. And in part, that's because he has a network of people around him who are happy to petition on his behalf, local gentlemen right up to one of the earls.
And he moves to the Hawkesbury, no recorded wife, but he's there's two kids, noted to have dark complexions. Tell us about that.
This is one of the things that has really, really bugged me throughout the whole research process, is this origin of William Kiss, which is James's son, and it's the my ancestral link to him. So James was an Englishman who is convicted, transported, winds up on the Hawkesbury as an assigned servant, and eventually occupying a plot of land. He then works there for a number of years, and there's plenty of good records, muster records and censuses, which means you can see him in situ year after year. You can see him in the same spot. You can see kind of what he was doing. And what happens is a few years later, two children suddenly appear in the records, William and Anne. Both William and Anne kiss, so they're ostensibly his children, and there's no evidence whatsoever of a mother, which is quite unusual because were she a convict, he would have to have applied for permission to marry from the convict department, as would she, which means that would produce a record. The chances of a white woman living in that part of the world without any kind of documentation at all is practically non-existent. So the most likely scenario seems to be that he is one of those men in that part of the world at that time who we know were forming relationships with local Aboriginal women.
This is great detective work, Nick. You're doing well. Now, one thing the colonial authorities did do well was record the appearance of convicts scrupulously. So it's clear you share little with your forebear, Joshua Higgs, who was 4 foot 11 inches tall, and I'm reliably informed you're a six-footer.
Yeah, I'm much taller than Joshua. Of course, people were smaller then anyway, but he's very small. And I can't help but imagine him as kind of a strong, wiry little figure nonetheless, because Joshua has a fascinating story. Joshua is he's another one of those convicts who were transported as a child. His offence was ostensibly stealing a cow, although he later told a story that he was just witlessly helping a fellow who he thought was moving the cow and ended up being charged with the theft of it and transported. But he also ends up as an assigned servant on the frontier. Nominally, he's a servant of William Cowper, I think from memory, around the Camden district. But he then crops up right down near Bega on the southeast coast of New South Wales, where he's part of that bovine expansion, if you will, the cattlemen clearing the country and setting up stations.
Well, one of the things he does is communicate often and well with the local Aborigines.
Yeah, because Joshua walked into a newspaperman's office late in life, I have actually a really good sense of his life because it's told in his words as an old man. And what he describes as being the oldest white man in the district is a phrase that he uses. And he also points out those relationships that he had with Aboriginal people. He wanted to make it known that he was the one who named Tarangandra, and he named it because obviously he had got that word from local Aboriginal people.
So clearly a relationship with some depth.
And a relationship with some complexity, yeah. He's somebody who's communicating with them and talking to them, obviously. And we know that in that part of the world, Aborigines are involved in the colonial economy in really interesting ways. One of the most famous ones is at the Bega whaling stations, where Aborigines would come in for a season of whaling and then continue on with their traditional ways throughout the rest of the year. So he's in that world where Aborigines are certainly participating in it, but not in a really well-documented way. Whereas on the other hand, he's also the one ancestor who comes the closest, I think, to direct frontier conflict, where he refers to another white settler who basically naively occupied a hut and did something to result in him getting killed. And then Joshua is part of the party that goes and finds the body with the aid of local Aboriginal boys who knew where it was.
We could spend 10 minutes more at least on Joshua, because he arrives with 300 cattle and some other blokes. They clear an acre, they sow wheat, they reap it, ground it in a steel mill. So and history records that he always worked hard, and he went blind in his later years.
Yeah, poor old Joshua. The reason he's in Bega reporting to a newspaperman is because he's there to see the doctor. And one of the complaints he has in his old age is that his sight is going. And this, of course, for a working man is a difficult thing. This is an age before welfare, so he was probably still working fairly late in life as much as possible.
You also make the point that despite him being a hard worker, he never cracked it for the middle classes. And you think this story shatters the myth of Australia as an egalitarian society.
Yeah, I think a lot of things that I've discovered trouble that myth. It's not that we don't aspire to it. It's that our history doesn't bear out strong, ubiquitous notions of egalitarianism in all stages of life. So Joshua's telling of his own story, it seems to me, in the late 19th century, is a case in point of somebody who worked very hard his entire life, who had a very raw deal early on in life, did the best that he could in the circumstances, and yet in the end was an old man wandering town to town, you know, gradually going blind. It's quite a sad story in a way. Whereas if you look at the histories being produced at the time, and many of the newspapers of the large metropolitan dailies in particular are starting to be very self-reflective about Australia's history. And it's very focused on the big men, the MacArthurs, the governors, people who had money or wealth or fitted in with it a certain framework of colonial development in the lead-up to the White Australia policy.
I think we should just pause a minute and explain to the listener how Trove helps you. I'm a great admirer of the National Library. It is, in fact, my favourite Canberra institution. So let's sing their praises via Trove. How does it work?
I'm happy to sing the praises of Trove. It is the most wonderful research tool in the entire world. And I can say that as someone who's trained in medieval history and does a lot of European history as well. And nobody anywhere has anything that is as effective or as accessible as Trove. So what Trove is a online repository, it's a complex thing. It's basically a large database. But the bit that I mostly use is the online repository of Australian newspapers. So they're gradually being digitised, and we've now passed through a process where most of the major towns and cities of Australia have most of their major newspapers already digitised, and it's going into the smaller, more obscure ones, which is a really great thing to be seeing happening at the moment. But it means that when you want to research something, you can go in and basically tap in a person's name, and it will search all of the newspapers in the country for those, for that name. It takes a bit of skill to get used to using it well, but it means that you can instantly access a huge range of material in ways that you couldn't beforehand.
One of the things you've found, Nick, is that because of the way things were documented, female forebears are more difficult to trace.
Yes, female forebears tend to be Mrs. So-and-so. So Mrs. Brodie could be anybody's Mrs. Brodie. And it's really only when you can provide a very definitive link to the male partner that you can be very certain.
But even male partners can be problematic, because you point out that your forebear, John O'Rafferty, also signed himself as John Munro, that many people had aliases back then.
Yes, very annoying. John O'Rafferty kept me busy for months and months, really, trying to track down exactly which John O'Rafferty, made worse by the fact that I come from a line of Johns where there's three John O'Rafferty's in a row. And there's a lateral branch of the family which also produces John O'Rafferty's with similar middle names as well. So there's at least two John Joseph O'Rafferty's running around at one point, at the same time in the same part of the world, actually. And it's very difficult to know that you've got the right one. So that kind of Trove-based research has to be very carefully framed around the traditional births, deaths and marriages, links and property records, and anything you can do to tie down and be absolutely certain that you've got the right person. And generally, I've erred on a fairly cautious line where if I wasn't certain, I'd either say explicitly that I wasn't certain or I wouldn't include it.
Female forebears. A couple of years ago, we did a program on the role of women at Eureka Stockade, and I find your take on Eureka, or on its aftermath, a lovely little conspiracy theory, quite compelling. You argue, or suspect, that following Eureka, giving men the vote was a way of governments keeping their eye on them, sort of a mega-data approach.
Yeah, it's no accident that the records of people suddenly expand in the wake of Eureka and the franchise. Giving people the vote meant that they had to register to vote, which meant that they had to provide a current documentation of their place of residence. And if you think about one of the things that government really struggled with during the gold rush, Eureka aside, it was just the rapid and extensive influxes of people such that cities would spring up overnight and within a few weeks they might have gone again. So you've got huge numbers of people moving around every which way, and it's very difficult for governments to therefore keep an eye on them, not just for the purposes of making sure that they don't engage in anything seditious, but also just to tax them and engage with them in those sorts of ways.
Now, let's go back to the Kiss family. In 1861, Jimmy, descendant of James, marries Catherine Higgs in Cooma. He gives her a gift of a horse called Robin. And by all accounts, he was a fine horseman, working his life with cattle. Is it possible that his antics on a horse inspired Banjo Paterson?
It certainly was thought that way by some of his descendants. He is one of a number of candidates that people consider might have been the inspiration for The Man from Snowy River. All that Paterson really ever said about it was that it was generally inspired, the poem was generally inspired by the horseman of his youth. Fortunately, Jimmy Kiss, unlike most of the other more famous contenders, actually fits within that framework. He is in the same area as the Pattersons when Paterson's a child, not when he's an adult. He's a famed horse rider. He's part of the a large clan of Kisses descended from the Kennedys and the Higgses, which are running cattle up and down between Gippsland and Sydney, basically, in the early days. So they're well-known horsemen. And Jimmy could apparently ride along and throw his hat on the ground and scoop it up without getting out of the horse and things like this. So it's the kind of fellow who would have engaged in horse riding that certainly could have stuck in the mind.
And, of course, by this time in the mid-19th century, newspapers are writing about the stories and the lives of the old settlers, and there's already a sense of the passing away of the pioneer days.
Yeah, and I think that's what Jimmy Kiss is part of, this phenomenon. His family sees him as those, as a connection to that early world later on. And it's very interesting that it's not just an isolated case of one family member saying that he was the inspiration for the poem, but that there's two story versions, in a way, which run down parallel lines of the family, and they crop up much later. One of them's from the 1930s. I can't quite remember when the other one was, but these are family stories which have passed down separate lines that are not linked to each other. It's not like one person says he was the man from Snowy River and then the person next door the next day said yes, he was. They're separate newspapers and it's separate stories.
Now, another great point about Jimmy, the grandson of the Irish political prisoner Thomas Kennedy, that he'd been moved to collect money for the Fenians, the Irish state prisoners transported to Western Australia in the 1860s. Irish sympathisers, no doubt, but they were well aware of events in the wider world.
Yeah, that's, again, we come back to Trove in a way, because Trove means Australia's history is really easy to write, and part of that is also the fact that there are that many newspapers. And from the mid-19th century, there are lots and lots of local newspapers springing up all over the place. And one of the things you'll notice if you go through them is that they're not really full of local news in the way that local newspapers today often are. They're generally outward-looking, and they're trying to bring in news from outside for people, because, of course, you can get the local gossip down at the pub, but what you want to do is read something from outside. And Jimmy Kiss was a subscriber for a time to a Catholic newspaper, and of course that gave him that kind of Catholic global outlook. And of course the Irish part of that story was a really big part of that, which is why he knew what was going on. So the colonies in Australia were much better informed about happenings in their world than I think we often give them credit for.
It's interesting the way history in Australia has tended in the past to write out so many of its indigenous themes. Where I live in the upper Hunter, local historians tend to manage to forget that this wasn't a white nation. Have you found that in your researches?
Well, I suppose in one sense, no, because I do a lot of frontier engagement research. So I probably have too far the other way. I'm too cognizant of it all the time. What I've tried to do with Kin is to look at it in as natural a way as possible, which means I'm not focusing solely on conflict. I'm not trying to write conflict out. I'm not trying to deliberately write people in. I'm not trying to ignore them, which means that throughout the course of the book, and therefore the course of my ancestral histories, people often do encounter Indigenous people. The probable marriage at the Hawkesbury is a case in point, but there's also more obvious ones. Like Jimmy Kiss, for instance, his brother is in a series of horse races in Cooma in the mid-19th century. And one of his great rivals at the time is an Aboriginal fellow. And this is described in the newspapers, and they've got a bit of rivalry going on. And it's that everyday kind of engagement that I think is really helpful to help normalise the sense that Aboriginal people are there. They're not an other. You don't need to give them their own chapter. You just need to include them whenever it's natural to do so, just as you would with Irish people or Pacific Islanders or whoever else happens to turn up.
Please understand, I was referring to local histories I've read over the years where Aboriginal involvement in large cattle properties remains a bit of an embarrassment. So they do tend, if you'll forgive the pun, to be whited out. Let's move on. I can remember not so long ago when AIDS suddenly appeared in our social and medical landscape, that many ministers were suggesting that it was God's punishment for homosexuality. One of your forebears, Dil Mackey, was pretty similar in a way. He's an outspoken Presbyterian, very anti-Catholic, and he suggests in 1900 that the bubonic plague is a form of punishment for the sins of the city.
Yes, poor old Dil Mackey. He's probably the character that most interested me, actually, writing Kin, because he was famous in his own time. He met more other Australians probably than any other one of my ancestors. He had large, I think it was the Melbourne Age editor, Riley, referred to as monster demonstrations. He was a undoubted bigot, but also a very complex man. He was, on the one hand, a Presbyterian minister who was very dedicated to his flock and would go to some extraordinary lengths to help people, including those just in his suburb who are not even co-religionists. So on the one hand, he's a very charitable person. But on the other, he grew up in Northern Ireland and he had a huge chip on his shoulder about a Catholic conspiracy to take over the world, which even in its day was seen by many people as nonsense. But it was also believed by many people. And so he's a great way of introducing the Orangemen phenomenon in Australia, which has kind of not attracted the historical attention it perhaps deserves, because it really illustrates the great deal of sectarianism that took place basically about the time that Australia's federating and a decade or so either side.
In a couple of hundred years, some young scholar will be doing research. He may be using the same sort of technology, and he'll come across you, Nick Brody, and be quite proud that you're one of his antecedents. Nick Brody, author of Kin, A Real People's History of Our Nation, published by Hardy Grant. 10 out of 10 for you, Nick, and a rarely bestowed koala stamp. And on our next, more history, very different history, the history of Vietnam, as seen by American author and activist Lady Borden. Lady is her name, incidentally, not her title. Stick around now on RN for the news, and we will see you later.